where I had to get
that was pretty easy.
Yeah, I think. I'm trying to remember what Randy's
on. Committee to order. Before we begin with our presentation from education rock stars Greg Crow and Tim Strom, just a couple of items for members. First of all, we are happy to be televised today on House TV, so just members to be aware of that. And to see distinguished alumni of the House, such as Representative Willie Dominguez in the audience as well. Happy to see him. Two things I forgot to mention in our first meeting. First of all, with regards to attendance, I know that some committees require members to check in with the committee legislative assistant to say when they're going to be gone or when they're going to be absent. In this committee, if you're not here, it's assumed that you're excused. You have some other thing going on. There's no reason for you to call Ms. Pico and tell us you're not going to be here. If you're not here, you will be marked excused on all attendance issues for those matters. Second of all is that we do have a Twitter account set up for this committee to make announcements or give people updates on things. It seems to be a little bit more instantaneous and quicker. And that Twitter feed is at MNEDU Finance. So Min Education Finance is the Twitter feed, MNEDU Finance. And you can look for that for periodic updates on what's going on. So let's see. Representative Kelly moves approval of the minutes dated January 5th. Is there any discussion, corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion passes. Our agenda item today is, once again, education rock stars Greg Crow and Tim Strom will be here to present to do an overview of just some of the part of the education finance budget and the general education formula, categoricals, and thoughts. In terms of questions from members in the committee, what we'll do is we'll just get the attention of the committee administrator and we'll put your name down. We will not immediately stop testimony every time someone has a question, but we'll kind of we'll let things queue up, and we'll take a break periodically to allow members of the committee to ask their questions. But if the committee administrator recognizes you and puts you on the list, just realize it may not be immediately. We don't want to break up the super information flow from these two gentlemen. So, gentlemen, thank you, and welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tim Strom from House Research, and with me today is Greg Crow from the House Fiscal Analyst's Office. We're going to try and get through a lot of material regarding school finance today. We're happy to have questions as we go through the material, so just raise your hands and the chair will recognize you if you've got questions. What we'd like to do is spend a little bit of time setting the background for school finance, and then we're going to get into the details pretty quick. We've got information in your folders, a couple things that you should be aware of. You've got both a blue and a brown guide to school finance. You've got two different versions because they have a different approach toward how to describe the system. The blue version tends to be more of a historical catalog of programs, and the brown version tends to be more of a version that allows you to put in an example, work through the actual numbers, and see how each of the formulas turns out. What Mr. Crow and I would like to accomplish today is to give you enough familiarity with the formula so that when we start hearing bills in the next week or so, that you have some sense of what these different components of the school finance formulas are and what happens if you change them. The PowerPoint that's on your screen on the screen today is also in your folder. It's oriented landscape and says Minnesota School Finance Overview on the cover of that. We're going to start with that. Mr. Crow is going to start walking you through that. After we finish that, we're going to talk for just a moment about the guidebooks, and then we'll talk about the aid and levies worksheet, and then we're going to get into an actual school finance printout with revenue by component and start talking about those components and show how they look for individual districts and show you some of the tricks we've got for sorting them and that kind of thing. So with that, Mr. Crow is going to start walking you through the PowerPoint.
Mr. Chair and members, if I turn to page 2, basically kind of a big picture overview to start about where K-12 fits into the whole budget system, and we'll look at the total state budget. We'll look a little bit at property taxes, enrollment, how revenues are decided, and then total school expenditures. So page 3 is basically where does money come from? How does the state get its money in total? And you can see from the chart on page 4. That the biggest piece is the individual income tax, which is about half of the state budget, and then sales tax account for about another quarter. Then there's corporate income taxes, statewide business property taxes, and some smaller revenue streams. Then where does that money go? The chart on page 6 gives you a sense of the total state budget by program area. And K-12 education in this case includes early childhood education, and it accounts for about 43% of the state budget. The next largest piece is health and human services at 30%, and then intergovernmental aids, and obviously then it gets smaller. But you'll be looking at almost half of the state budget when you make your decisions about your appropriations and what you want to spend and how you want to allocate it. K-12 has historically been the biggest piece of the state budget, and so there'll be a lot of attention focused on it and on you and your decisions. Then let's just jump into property taxes a little bit, and I think Tim is going to cover property taxes.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as Mr. Crow said, the state aids are a large part of school district funding, so the portion that you decide as the state appropriations has a lot to do with how much revenue school districts get. The school districts also get some of their money from the property tax, and for that reason, this committee needs to have an understanding of how the property tax system in Minnesota works and what some of the trends are in that property tax system and the portion of the school funding that comes from the property taxes. In Minnesota, we start with something called the market value of the property, and that's just essentially if you were to go and assess the value of each piece of property in the state for the value you think it'd sell at, that would be its market value. All told, for taxes payable in 2010, about $583 billion of tax property tax value out there. The biggest chunk of that, about half of that, is the homesteads, residential homes, the houses. 53% of that $583 billion is the value of each of our homes. Other residential property, which includes rental property and non-resident homestead properties, about 11% of the total. Commercial industrial property is about 15% of the total, slightly smaller than the agricultural lands on market value, which are 16%. And then cabins are referred to as seasonal rec property. Now take a good look at these percentages, and then we're going to turn the page here. This is the assessed market value of the property in the state. But when we look at who actually pays the property tax, you can see for the same year, for taxes payable in 2010, about $7.9 billion of property tax is paid by this property. But because of deliberate decisions that the legislature makes about how to value property for tax purposes, residential homestead property drops from the 50-some percent to 44% of the total property taxes paid. Commercial industrial property, remember from that last slide, it was 15% of the total market value. They pay 35% of the total property tax for schools in this state. Agricultural lands is just the opposite. They're 16% of the market value in the state, and they pay only 7% of the school property taxes in the state. The reason this is hugely important is decisions that you make and that the tax committee make have to do with how these different classifications for property are made, and school levies will affect properties differently depending on which tax base you use to levy these against. So again, a real important concept. We use class rates in Minnesota to go from market value to taxes paid, and those class rates make deliberate policy to reduce the burden on residential homestead and farm properties and to increase the burden on commercial properties relative to their share of the market value. When we look at that $7.8 billion of property tax, you can see that that's collected by a variety of units of local government. School districts are near the largest, not quite the largest yet, 27% of the total. County governments collect 31% of the total property tax in the state. Cities collect 22%. Townships, another 2%. Special taxing districts collect 4 percentage points of the property tax paid in the state. And about 4% is in tax increment finance or TIF districts, so they're off the tax base for purposes of school taxes. And about 10% of the total property taxes paid are through the statewide business tax, which goes against seasonal rec and commercial industrial property. And you're going to hear a lot about that, I'm sure, this year. But that tax is actually a property tax against business and cabins that is paid directly to the state, and that's about 10% of that total for taxes payable in 2010. So in summary, the property tax system, even though state aids are the major part of school funding in Minnesota, property tax system, 27% of the total property taxes statewide are used to help fund the schools.
Mr. Strom, I don't think this is later on in the presentation, but because we have so many new members in the committee, could you briefly just explain the difference between referendum market value and adjusted net tax capacity?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, we have two separate tax bases, and when we start talking about levies a little later in the presentation, we'll talk about which levies are on those two tax bases. But basically, most of your levies are on something called net tax capacity, and net tax capacity is the one that reflects the legislative class rates applied to the market value of the property. So, for example, on a homestead property for the first $500,000 of value, the class rate is 1%. So if I own a home that's valued at $200,000, my tax value of that, my net tax capacity is $2,000. It's the 1% class rate times the $200,000 of value. Similarly, the class rate for business property is 2%. So if I were to own a $200,000 business, my class rate of 2% times that would give me a $4,000 net tax capacity. And by the same token, the ag lands have a class rate that's about 0.5. So if I've got a $200,000 ag lands, I'm going to have about $1,000 of net tax capacity. So what it basically means is net tax capacity, when we use that tax base, business and property pays more relative to the homestead property. When we use market value, we use the business property pays less compared to the residential homestead. They both have the same ratio. The whole amount of the value is on. And there are two other little twists when we use referendum market value, and that is that seasonal rec property does not pay on any tax that's levied on referendum market value, and neither do the ag lands. So both of those are excluded from paying for the levies that are against referendum market value. Now, the main tax that's against referendum market value is the one that's the voter-approved operating referendum. There are four other little taxes against the referendum market value, but the main one is the voter-approved operating referendum. And what that means is that the taxes that are paid on that are not paid by ag lands or cabins, and they're paid in equal proportion to their market value for residential, homestead, and commercial industrial property. On the other hand, building bonds and most of the other levies are on what we call net tax capacity, and there the class rates apply, and residential property pays relatively less than commercial industrial, and ag lands as a percent of its value pay even less than the residential because of the legislatively set class rates.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And again, I know we have all the minority members are returning to this committee, but on the majority side, we have quite a young group of people, so if periodically we do that stuff, I hope members don't mind, and maybe even offer a little refreshing course for some of us. So, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair and members, then let's talk a little bit about student enrollment. If you turn to page 12, there's a chart that shows what's happened to student enrollment over time. As you can see, enrollment peaked in about 1972 with the baby boom and then declined pretty rapidly through the 80s. And bottomed out in about 1985. Then we had a slower growth rate, but got back almost halfway up to where the peak was, and then started declining again in the early 2000s. At this point, we're projecting that the enrollment is pretty flat and actually starting to grow into the future. Now, we still have a very large number of districts that, even though the aggregate for the state is stable or growing, we do have a large number of districts that individually are experiencing declining enrollment. And if you look at the page 14, you can see by region where the decline and the growth is happening. And the two places where there's growth are East Central Region and the 7-county metro area. Now, if you look at the previous page, you see that more than half of the students on page 13, more than half of the students are in the metro region, in the metropolitan area, and then the East Central Region accounts for 10%. And so that's what accounts for the fact that even though there's only growth in two regions, there's still statewide growth, is that the number of students in growing districts is higher than the number of districts that are experiencing declines alternatively. So on page 15, you can see kind of that picture represented in a different way, and that's the number of students, or the percent of students enrolled by school district size. So basically what it shows is that we have a lot of very small districts and a few very large districts. So the bar on the right that shows that 70% of the state's students are enrolled in the 66 largest school districts. So the balance of the school districts, the other roughly 280, contain less than 30% of students. And so we have one thing you probably wonder yourself, or you've already wondered, is why the funding formulas are so complicated. And we'll talk about some of those reasons. But one of those reasons is that we have districts that look very different than each other. And in an effort to address those differences and try and treat districts somewhat fairly, the legislature has tried to craft a funding system that reflects districts that are really, really different. And so, you know, the issues that a very small district has are different than a large metropolitan district, for example. So the chart on page 16 kind of shows the enrollment change between 2003 and 2010. Yeah, and 2010 by school type. You can see school districts are declining in total in that period. Charter school enrollment has grown significantly. And then there's some other demographic information at the bottom where special education student growth has been about 9% over the time, which, you know, averages around 1% a year. There's been significantly higher growth in the free and reduced price lunch populations, the populations of students with limited English proficiency, that's what LEP stands for, and students of color. And all of those things factor into various funding formulas and account for some of the, and can account for growth in state aid payments, even with declining enrollment.
Next, we're going to look at a little bit of revenue by funding stream. And when we do that, we're going to come back to this in a little bit. You've all got a printout in your packet. And that printout is a standard printout that we'll use on this committee that shows revenue on a per-pupil basis, on a district-by-district basis, by category. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. We want to give you a little overview, a little context first before we start working off the printout. But the printout's on the legal size paper turned sideways. It takes usually about 14 pages to show the 330 school districts and the 150 or so charter schools when we turn the paper this way. It gives you some sense of the volume of this. The printouts that Mr. Crow and I put together, we're happy to share electronically with people if people like to use spreadsheets, and you can look at those and sort those in ways that are helpful to you. The reason we're going to talk a lot about the printout and about the way the funding sources, the general education funding sources are, and the revenue by stream is divided, is that's what this committee spends the bulk of its time doing.
I'm sorry, Mr. Strom. Mr. Crow, could you, and I apologize for interrupting you midstream there, but in terms of you measured attendance and enrollment, can you briefly just discuss the different terms that are used in measuring attendance? For example, on our spreadsheets, we're using adjusted marginal cost pupil units versus ADMs. Just briefly explain to committee members how, you know, for example, a third grader and an 11th grader are not the same thing with regards to AMCPU, and then explain the 77% provision for declining enrollment districts.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, it might be helpful to look in your book. Why don't you take the blue book out? It's on page 15. There's also a definition of pupil weighting on page 7 of the brown book. But if you look on page 15, there's a basically a four-step process that gets us from a headcount of the pupils from a headcount to a to what we call the weighted count, or AMCPUs, or sometimes when we talk about pupil units, what we're referring to is that weighted headcount, because that's what we usually use when we're looking at a particular formula. looks like most people are there. Basically, what we do is we take a head count, and the first thing we do is you count the kids that are out there. The second thing you do is take that head count and you only count the kids that are being served in a particular school district. In the past, we used to have transfers between districts when students would open enroll, for example. But now what we do is we actually add that pupil when we count adjusted average daily membership. Average daily membership, I skim over things that I have to make sure I define. So average daily membership is basically the head count of students. Then we have adjusted average daily membership, which is the head count of students served in that school district. So when there's an open enrollment student that comes in, that student is counted in the serving district's adjusted average daily membership. Then we have adjusted pupil units, which is pupil units that are weighted based on their grade level. And I think the chart, it's on page 7 of the brown book, and the chart that shows in the blue book refers to table 9. So it's on the next page. So you can see on page 16 how we weight students. And if you look at the top line, and it's up on the screen now, kindergarten students are weighted at 0.612. First through third graders at 1.115, fourth through sixth graders at 1.06, and secondary students at 1.3. So when you go from the adjusted average daily membership to the adjusted pupil units, you apply that weight. So one head count high school student being served in a district counts as 1.3 weighted adjusted pupil units. And then finally, when we calculate that for each school district, we factor in a method for helping districts compensate for declining enrollment. And that's the fourth step on page 15, adjusted marginal cost pupil units. What happens there is that the school district's pupil count, this weighted pupil count, is if the district is in decline, we calculate their weighted pupil count as the sum of 77% of their current year's pupil units plus 23% of the previous year's pupil units. So some of the pupil units that have that wouldn't count if we didn't do this weighting, in other words, they would disappear as the enrollment declined, are counted in the current pupil count for a declining enrollment district, basically to kind of for 1 year soften the blow of that declining enrollment. And it's called marginal cost pupil units because there's some discussion about the marginal cost and the marginal savings of additional or fewer pupil units. As you add pupils, if you add a couple of students, you can put them in a classroom, and there's little marginal cost to adding those pupils because you don't necessarily have to add a teacher. As you're declining, you don't necessarily get marginal, your marginal cost savings are lower because if you lose one or two pupils or even five or six pupils, you can't necessarily reduce your costs by the amount of revenue that you lose because those students have left. And so this is rather than having a dedicated declining enrollment formula, which has been proposed and talked about in the past, or there's other methods for dealing with declining enrollment, the current funding formula uses this pupil weighting to try and address the issue of declining enrollment.
And Mr. Chair, members, if I could just add, the pupil counting is extremely complicated for something that could be quite simple. But one of the problems with this is any attempt to undo that is going to make changes amongst districts. And some districts are going to be big winners and others big losers if we change those pupil counts from where they are. All of the reasons that went into them sort of make sense in the abstract, but they lead to a count of pupils that's really quite cumbersome. The count that you have there, the adjusted marginal cost pupil units, or AMCPUs, that's the one we use for funding purposes for nearly all formulas. When we get to general ed and some of the other formulas, you'll see that count on there. That's that weighted count of pupils. The kinds of things that are controversial about that are on the decline. Is the declining marginal cost really the right amount? Basically, what we're saying is you get one more year for one out of every four students that leaves with marginal cost. Is that sufficient? Is that too much? when we talk about the weighting by grade levels, does it make sense any longer to weight students by grade levels? The reason that we have higher weights at those early elementary grades was to try and reduce the class sizes at those grades. Whether that was a sensible way to do it or not may not be too clear, but we have that additional weighting. If you look at that chart on the next page there, that additional weighting is higher at the early elementary grades at 1.115 for that reason, that we wanted additional class size reduction at that grade level. The secondary weighting reflects that secondary programs used to be more expensive to operate. In the good old days, that weighting was at 1.5 for secondary students. Over the last 25 years, that's dropped down to 1.3 now. I don't believe there's been any studies done recently. The last study that was done about 15 years of relative expenditures by grade level suggested secondary needed a weight about 25% bigger than elementary if it was to correspond to where the costs were. But there's rationale for having a system like that. But it does make it somewhat complicated, and that's one of the things this committee will be looking at, no doubt, this year as well. One final issue, as Mr. Crow mentioned, we use that adjusted count of pupils, pupils served, not kids resident, for most funding purposes. The one primary exception to that is the operating referendum, the additional taxes your voters vote on for the schools. That's based on resident kids, but most all of the other funding formulas are based on the actual number of kids that are served, not the number of kids that live within your district that attend a public school.
And just a cautionary note, as we look at these printouts, and we generally, when we distribute things, calculate them on a per AMCPU basis, on a per weighted pupil basis. It's usually more helpful to look on a per pupil basis than a total dollars basis, because the difference between Minneapolis and Aiken is going to be significant on a total dollars basis, but you don't see why until you look on a per pupil basis. So we often do things on a per pupil basis, but a caution, if you're looking from one set of spreadsheets to another, is that since there are fewer headcount students, if you're comparing a spreadsheet where someone has made a calculation on a per ADM basis, a per headcount basis, you're going to have a different result with the exact same revenue than if you look at a spreadsheet that looks on a per weighted student basis. And so that might generate some confusion. So it's important to kind of know exactly what it is that you're looking at.
Mr. Chair, so with that, we're going to just set a little context for the K-12 spending before we go to talking about how the aids and levies spreadsheets work, and then we'll come back to the individual components of general ed and talk about what those are and show you how those vary by school district. When we talk about the budget for the year we're currently in, which is fiscal year 2011, that's the 2010-2011 school year, the property taxes from payable 10 go with that year, and the aid appropriations from fiscal year 2011 go with that year. When we take the sum of all the revenue, the aid entitlement plus the property taxes plus the federal funds plus the fees that are paid for this school year, we're expecting that the schools in Minnesota, the charters and public school districts, will spend $10.9 billion in total, that their revenue will be $10.9 billion. More than half of that comes through the general education program, which is why we'll focus a lot on that program. About 7% of the total comes from the voter-approved operating levy. Another 9.4% is for facilities purposes. You can see special programs, the revenue for special education is about 8% of the total. A little note for you here, when we look at expenditures, you'll see most districts are spending about double that on special education. So our funding for special education is about 8% of the total. Most district spending is about 16% and up for special education. So that means a fair amount of special education spending is coming out of that general ed money.
This might be a place also to just talk about revenue versus spending. When we do printouts, we're generally showing you information about school district revenue. You may get a question about how much your district spends or how much the state's spent in total. The spending information is different than the revenue information. Partly, as Tim says, special education isn't fully funded by the revenue stream, so school districts take their general ed money out of general programs and pay for special education. Districts sometimes will spend their balances down or add to their balances, in which case for one year their revenues for that year, the revenues won't match their spending. And our data on spending is not nearly as good or up to date. Well, it's good. It's just not as up to date as our revenue projections. We do revenue projections going out into the future, and they're usually fairly close. The Department of Education uses a system of expenditure reporting to calculate all of the spending that school districts do in the state, and that usually lags by a year or so when we can get final data about what school districts spent. So if you come to us and ask for spending data, we'll usually tell you we can't give you current spending data, and that's why. It's not we're trying to prevent you from getting what you need. It's just it's not really available, and it's more the revenue information is what's available and what we tend to do printouts based on.
So, for example, right now, the most up-to-date revenue information we have, we can estimate out through 2014 fairly comfortably. But for spending information, 2009 is the last year we have good spending information for. 2010, we'll get that spending information in the next couple of months. But so we can tell you what happened 2 years ago on a spending side, and we can tell you what's going to happen a couple years out, provided no changes on the revenue side. So we tend to focus a lot more on the revenue side. And the other reason, of course, is this committee is going to be looking at moving the levers around on the revenue side, probably not so much on the spending side. Those decisions are made by the local school boards, and so what you're going to be controlling, generally speaking, is the revenue side of things.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, so is it accurate to say that it is information is not available, readily available in current time to determine how much of the federal slice, 8.5%, is applied to or added to special programming of 8.2%? Because that would be an example of how the revenue and the spending flows don't mesh.
Yes, exactly. Mr. Chair, Representative Anzell, we would have to call your individual school districts for fiscal year 11, the year we're currently in, and say, how much of the federal special ed funding that you got this year are you spending in this year to get a guess of that? And we wouldn't have any systematic way of doing that. For fiscal year 10, we've got more systematic ways of doing that, even though the data is not complete yet. But you're exactly right.
Thank you.
And Mr. Strom, where does the, or Mr. Crow, either one of you, where does the federal stabilization dollars tie into these charts? And that's, if you just translate what the stabilization dollars are. And
Mr. Chair, committee members, there were two big chunks of fiscal stabilization money in the K-12 world. Much of that was used in fiscal year 10. There was a $500 million chunk of federal funds in fiscal year 10 that the federal government essentially gave states a variety, you know, differing amounts per state. But for Minnesota, that $500 million, the state of Minnesota was told, you can spend this on your schools however you want, and you can offset any of your other spending that you'd be doing on schools with this money. So for fiscal 10, which isn't in the documents you have here, but is on the spreadsheet, the aid spreadsheet that Mr. Crow has in front of you, about $500 million of federal funds were distributed that year as just an offset to general education. There's other federal funds that were in the stimulus money, a fair amount of additional Title I funding and a fair amount of additional special education funding. And those amounts are distributed primarily in fiscal years 10 and 11, although the way districts can use those, they can carry those forward and apply those to different years to use. But from a revenue point of view, most of those funds are going out in 10 and 11. And as I said, when we look at the statewide printouts, Mr. Crow can separate out and will show you why some of the numbers on there are so different, and that's primarily because of that federal stimulus money. You'll often hear that referred to as its acronym, which was ARRA money. But that money primarily went in fiscal years 10 and 11.
And Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, that is this is one of the factors in education finance or overall budgeting where the numbers are accurate, but some could argue they leave a misleading perception. In the case of the stabilization money from the state general fund spending account, that would be listed as a spending reduction. Even though the amount of spending was equal, if you're looking at a spreadsheet, that books in general fund accounts as a spending cut, correct?
As a revenue cut, yes, from the school district level. From the state level, the state could look at it as a spending cut. Yes.
Correct. And then going forward as the that's one-time money. As that money goes away and the state for lack of a better word, reestablishes its commitment on those dollars, those are booked as increases in expenditures, whereas the other side of the argument would be nothing's changed. Through three biennium, you've just changed where the sources of the revenue for those expenditures have come from.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, primarily for that $500 million, the extra Title I money and the extra special ed money was actual additional spending facilitated by the and the jobs money facilitated by the federal funds. But the $500 million in fiscal year 10 was a direct offset to state general education aid.
Now, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kroer, Mr. Strom, while we're talking about special ed, the federal mandate in the 70s gave a promise to the states that they would reimburse the states about 40% of the cost of special ed, and we know, and as you suggested, that that has significantly increased the spending for special education, has significantly increased since then. And can you tell us, school districts have had to use general funds or cross-subsidized special ed payments. Can you tell us about what percentage right now the feds are reimbursing the states at out of their 40% promise?
Mr. Kroer, Mr. Schramm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, we've got some special ed slides back in the page 37 and thereabouts. We don't have that particular chart there. We're guessing that's right around 20%. The additional federal funds from the stimulus bill pushed us back up from 18 to about 20%. We'll check on that number for you, but that's about as high as we've ever been. I'll find a chart for you while Mr. Crow is going through the next couple sections here, and we'll put that up on the screen for you to show you that amount.
Any other questions, Representative Ward? Mr. Crow, Mr. Schramm.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, I think we are on page 20. Did we do the chart on 18? If you look at page 19, the general education pie piece on page 18 showed about 54% of school district revenue is in the general education program. So that's obviously the largest piece of it. So then, just to kind of give you a sense of what makes that pie up, that's what page 19 does. About $6.7 billion in fiscal 11 is what that pie piece is, the general education revenue. And that $6.7 billion is made up of all of those components that are in the columns of that long legal size printout that is in your packet. And we'll go through that separately, but basically to get a sense, basic aid, which is the general funding formula, used to be called the foundation formula, but the basic amount that everyone gets for every student generates almost $5 billion of that. So if you look at the chart or the pie chart on page 20, basic revenue is almost three-fourths, almost 75% of school district funding. The next biggest piece is referendum at about 12%, and referendum revenue is the voter-approved operating levies that you hear about getting passed by individual school districts. So the two biggest pieces accounting for about almost 85% of general education funding are the basic formula and then the optional referendum revenues that districts have gone out for and successfully raised. Some of the other big pieces then, compensatory revenue is about 6%, and that 6% amounts to about a little over $400 million revenue to school districts. Operating capital is about 3%, which amounts to about $200 million. So those are sort of the biggest pieces, but once you get below those pieces of the pie get pretty small. And all this is sort of to give you context as you think about what you're going to end up doing with education funding. If you have to make a cut, for example, sometimes you're just kind of messing around at the edges with some of the smaller programs, and if you have to make a big cut, there's only a few big pieces of pie there to deal with.
And Mr. Crow, with regards to the, and it's just an observation, Representative Greiling, is that I like this. I get to ask questions whenever I want. This is great.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Greiling.
And I get to play on my phone.
We really have switched spots, haven't we? Mr. Crowell, with regards to that 12% of referendum, some people may think that 12% represents just state, just local property tax dollars, and other people may think that 12% just represents the equalization portion of that. Can you just very briefly, without getting too muddy, explain what that money is?
Sure, Mr. Chair, and that'll give us a chance to define another term quickly. The top of this chart says general education revenue. Usually when you see something from us that says revenue, that's a total of aid, state aid appropriated by you all in your bill and local property tax levies raised by local school districts. And so that referendum pie includes a portion. The largest part is about $900 million of levy. For fiscal 11, actually it's about $720 million of levy raised by local school districts. And then on top of that, and we'll get into this as we talk about operating referendum, there's about $80 million in that fiscal year of state aid that that basically the state says will help districts that have lower property values raise what their voters have approved with less of a tax burden. And so a portion of that out of a total of $800 million, roughly 10% of that 12% pie piece is state aid, and about 90% of it is local property taxes. So if you wanted to divide that pie, it'd be about 1% referendum aid and about 11% referendum levy.
Representative Loom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question was also with regards to referendum. Is this the 12% on your pie chart, is that strictly operating levy referendums, or would it encompass other things like for technology or other levies that may?
Mr. Crowell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, it represents all voter-approved operating referendums, and sometimes when they ask the question, they include, they describe it as for technology, but this just includes all operating referendums that are voter approved. It wouldn't include debt referendums, for example, and it wouldn't include specifically authorized operating type levies that districts can raise, for example, for a building lease, or we have health and safety levies. We have levies for safe schools that they can use for operating costs, like for police or in the schools, for example. It doesn't include those types of operating cost levies that districts are allowed to raise. Operating referendum just means, when it's included in general education, only means voter-approved levies.
Mr. Chair, when we go through the levy sheet, we'll point these out, but there are three levies that are voter-approved, and the rest are all at the discretion of the school board, subject to the state levy limits. And those three that are voter-approved are the operating referendum, the main ones that you hear about in the fall when school districts go to the polls. There's also the building debt, which is the second one, where what the voters are actually doing is approving the sale of building bonds. The question is usually phrased as approving a certain dollar amount of bonds. And then the third is there's something called the down payment or the capital projects levy, and that's a short-term levy of up to 5 years that's approved by the voters. But those are the three that are voter-approved, and all the rest of the school levies are determined here at the legislature with a maximum amount, and then school boards, if they fit the categorizations and the characterizations of those levies, can levy up to the maximum set by the legislature for each of those categories.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question that I've had for quite some time, and I just would like clarified. On the QComp piece of that pie, does that also include money collected through local property taxes?
Mr. Crowell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, yes, it does. The QComp revenue is a mix of aid and levy, and it's sort of three-part because it's the levy is then an equalized levy. It's equalized at a fairly low rate. So the levy then is a mix of aid and levy, equalized aid and the levy. So there's actually kind of two parts of aid. One is there's aid, and then there's equalization aid, and then there's levy. And districts are not required. This is one of the few programs, and we'll probably talk about this as we go through, but districts aren't required to levy in this program in order to collect the aid. In many cases, if it's a mix of aid and levy, you've specified that they have to make the levy in order to get the aid. In the case of QComp, They don't have to. They can just levy. Yeah, if you look on page 26 of the Brown Book, I'm going to walk through an example on QComp. And you'll see the mythical Gopherville School District referenced here. And that's an example used to, and the number of pupils changes every example, so don't hold me to making them have 1,000 kids in every example. But anyway, basically $260 per pupil is what's available for QComp. And so in this case, the first calculation you make on 26 is how much, and the technical name for it is alternative teacher compensation revenue. Everyone calls it QComp because that's the name of the program that's basically in operation. So you take 260 times the pupil count, which is 1,000, and they qualify for $260,000. Of that, for 2010-11, the amount that's state aid is $169 per pupil, and the balance, $91, and this is set in statute, is levy. So their aid amount is 169 times 1,000, or $169,000. Then on the top of page 27, we calculate how much is their levy. Well, their levy is $91 times their enrollment of 1,000 students is $91,000. Well, we have a system in place in Minnesota where, in the case of many of our levies, we equalize those levies. And what equalization means is that in attempt to have rate equalization, which the equalizing factors haven't kept up with changes in property value, so we don't really have that. But in an attempt to make it easier for low property value districts to raise the same amount of money as high property value districts, we have this thing called equalization. And the way equalization works is you take basically we're taking the property wealth and dividing it by the equalizing factor that's set in statute, and that determines the percent of the revenue that is levy versus aid. So if the district's property value per student is half of the equalizing factor, then their levy will be half aid paid by the state and half allocated to local property taxpayers.
You got that, Representative Enzels?
Got her down.
Okay. So in the example, for alternative compensation revenue, the equalizing factor is $5,913 per pupil unit. And in the case of Gopherville, they're a low-value district, very low. They only have $2,000 per pupil of value. Right now, the state average, $7,000 per pupil. So Gopherville is a very low-value district in this example. So what we do then, you can see in the middle of page 27, is we take that $91,000 of levy and we multiply it by 2,000 divided by 5913, which is 33.8%. So what that means is that 33.8% of their levy revenue will be raised against the taxpayers. The balance will be paid by the state as equalization aid. So 33.8 times 91 is 30,758. So that's the amount of levy they have to raise. And then the state comes in and says, well, because we set the value there and your value is so low, we're going to backfill that $91,000 to make sure you get that full amount and pay you an additional $60,242 of equalization aid. So the long answer to your question then is it's a mix of aid and levy, but the aid portion is both aid revenue as defined in statute and equalization aid. So in this case, they end up with about $190,000 or $200,000 worth of aid and $220,000, $230,000 worth of aid, and about $30,000 worth of levy. And even though the mix is 169 and 91 of aid and levy in the QComp program. And that's it in short, I guess.
Dietrich, did you have a follow-up?
So, I know, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to also point out that's not voter-approved, correct?
Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, that's correct. That is one of the, and as we look at the levy sheet, as Tim mentioned, there are three voter-approved levies, and this isn't one of them. Most of the
That's a good question.
most of the dollars are in voter-approved levies, but most of the levies that districts make are not voter-approved. They're at board discretion, contingent on their qualification in state statute.
And Mr. Krell, would it be a fair statement to say that, you know, generally speaking, I think we put these into boxes where we say schools can't levy without voter approval, and cities and counties can always levy whatever they want. And the reality is that, generally speaking, cities and counties have much more authority to levy in most cases, and school districts, generally speaking, have less authority to levy in most cases. But there are exceptions on both sides that we could argue.
Well, Mr. Chair, on the school side, there really aren't exceptions. There's no discretion for a district to levy for whatever reason it wants. We have two categories of levies. They're voter approved, and so if they go to the voters and get an operating levy or a facilities levy approved, they can levy for that. At their discretion, they can levy for things, but they can only levy for things that are authorized by you in your bill. And so there isn't, the only discretion there is to potentially levy less than they're authorized to levy for. So there are certain costs, for example, like unemployment insurance or building lease levies at a certain level, the crime levy or the safe schools levy I mentioned, which is set at a dollar amount per pupil. They can levy for any of those things, but only to the extent they qualify. They can only levy for unemployment insurance if they have unemployment insurance costs. They can only levy for safe schools up to a certain dollar amount per pupil. And so really their only discretion on the voter or on the board approved levies is whether to levy the full amount that's authorized by you in law or not. And cities and counties have much fewer restrictions on them outside of the levy limits, yes, in general.
Mr. Chair, cities and counties are subject occasionally to legislative levy limits that work slightly different. And the legislature has a split mind. It goes many years without imposing those and then decides it needs to impose those. Those levy limits generally are not categorical. There are some categorical exceptions to those, but generally speaking, there's a growth factor, a certain amount that the levy or the levy plus aid for a city or county can be. So those levy limits, when they're placed on cities and counties by the legislature, operate slightly different than the way the school world works. But as Mr. Crow says, the schools are subject to hard levy limits, with the only exceptions being those three programs where you're allowed to vote. The taxpayers are allowed to vote for a higher level of levy than what the legislature specifies.
And I guess the reason why is I wanted to explain, because new members might think that schools don't have any authority to levy, and that's not accurate. I mean, if there's asbestos in the building, you find it, the voters don't get to decide whether to take that out or not. That's something that's beyond that realm. But, you know, Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, I'm thinking the members are still trying to hang on here. Let's really bury them, and let's explain how QComp works for charter schools, since they don't have levy authority.
Mr. Chair, actually, that's not a hard one. But if you look at Mr. Crow's book or my book on the alternative comp calculations, basically there they get the charter schools get the same funding as school districts on aid programs, and if there's a levy, usually they don't get the levy program. So the levy portion is usually not available to charter schools. There's some small exceptions, but generally speaking, that means that $169 is going to be the amount with some certain exceptions.
We'll save the exceptions for another committee hearing. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So just to clarify here, the QComp is a board-approved levy, and it's at the discretion of the school board. Is the other portion of the aid and levy codependent upon the levy itself, or do you get the aid? So you have to levy as a school board in order to get the aid portion of the additional aid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, you don't have to levy to get the basic aid, which is the $169 per pupil. To get the equalization aid, you have to make the levy and then get it equalized. Otherwise, you don't get that.
So they are codependent.
Representative Peterson, in a way.
Yep.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, this is different than most levies. If you look at Mr. Crow's spreadsheet on levies, if you jump ahead for just a minute, this is the single sheet that's printed portrait. The operating capital levy, for example, which is line 9, and we'll get to that in a minute, but that's one where the whole amount is dependent on the board making its share of the levy.
So the roughly $230 per kid that school districts get in operating capital revenue, if your board doesn't make that levy, you're going to forego the aid. If you make half the levy, you're going to forego the relative portion of the aid that goes with that related to your total. And the equalization is going to depend on the valuation of your district. So if you're getting 90% of it through state aid and 10% through the local levy, if you only levy half of that amount, you're going to lose a whole half of the state aid. It's proportional to the share of the levy that you're making.
Any follow-up, Representative Peterson? Representative Kelly.
No, actually, Mr. Chairman, me and Representative Peterson have the same question. Just to clarify, you would not have to levy to get the basic aid.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, if there aren't further questions, we'll jump ahead to a couple of real quick graphs, and then we'll come back to the aid and levy spreadsheets here. The next couple of graphs are designed to give you a little sense of why there's a huge gap in thinking between this committee particularly and the other committees at the legislature about what's happened to school funding over time. And if you look on page 21, you can see the top line there. This is a school district revenue chart for the last 25 years from 1984 to 2010. And if you look, you can see in 1984, the total revenue for school districts was just under $4,000 per pupil. And by 2010, it's up over $12,000 per pupil. So a pretty big increase on the nominal amounts of revenue per pupil. If you adjust that for inflation using the CPI, and we'll have a little discussion perhaps about what inflation measure is best to use, whether one should use the CPI or the GDP implicit price deflator, you can see that that amount goes from $4,000 to $6,000, considerably less, but still a year-to-year increase in real spending per student when we measure just taking the total revenue and dividing it by the inflation. If you were to take another chart, and this chart's on page 22, and take out two other expenses that school districts face. Take that revenue line, that $4,000 to $12,000 revenue line, and then back two expenses that aren't really related to the direct classroom instruction. If you factor out the amount that's spent on buildings, that's the black dotted line on the chart there, and you can see that spending goes up to slightly over $11,000 if you take the building spending out. And then the red line at the bottom says, what if you take the building spending out and the special ed spending out? And you can see the non-inflation adjusted line there goes from slightly over $3,000 to slightly under $10,000 for the change in per pupil revenue unadjusted by inflation. And then if we skip the next page and go to page 24, and we'll come back to the inflation in a minute. Then we've taken those same three lines we had on page 22, and we've adjusted those for the inflation measured by the CPI inflation factor. And you can see there that the revenue in 1984, excluding building costs and excluding special ed costs, was a little under $4,000 per kid, between $3,000 and $4,000 per kid. And now in 2010, 25 years later, it's slightly over $4,000 per kid. And all of these numbers, all nine lines you've just looked at here, are all very legitimate ways to describe school funding. So if someone wants to say that school funding went from $4,000 to $12,000 since 1984, that'd be a perfectly logical thing to say. That's certainly what's happened on the revenue front if you look at the nominal change in per school funding. And if someone else were to claim that, well, gee, school funding for the classroom hasn't really changed a whole lot over the last 25 years, if your definition of that is taking out the building debt and the special ed costs and then adjusting that by inflation, you get the number that looks like the line that looks like the red line here. And one could make the argument looking at that line that, gee, not a lot's changed. And both of these are very legitimate ways to look at school spending. There's no right or wrong with this, but you're going to hear a lot when school board people think about what you've done for them for education spending. They tend to look at this red line on page 24, and they say, well, geez, over the last 25 years, we've only gone from a little under $4,000 to a little over $4,000. When other people, particularly here at the legislature, talk about school funding in other committee areas, they'll say, well, golly, school funding's gone from just under $4,000 to more than $12,000 over the last 25 years. That's a phenomenal increase. And both of those lines are legitimate lines. Both of those tell a real story. But I think members of this committee are well served. They keep in mind that there's a couple of different ways to look at those. One last note, the chart that I have the adjustments on here uses the CPI as the adjustment. There are other measures of inflation, primarily the GDP, the gross domestic product implicit price deflator, Some have argued rather strenuously that that's a much better measure by which to divide state and local government services. If you, that inflation factor has been higher over this time period, particularly for the decade of the 2000s. And if you use an implicit price deflator, you're going to get a negative line on that trend line. The red line here would actually be going down over time, particularly from 2000 forward, if one were to use the GDP implicit price deflator. Again, it's not a right or wrong issue. There's legitimate reasons to use the CPI. There's legitimate reasons to use the GDP implicit price deflator. There's legitimate reasons to look at a nominal cost and not the real cost of something. One can factor in inflation or not, and there are both logical things to do, but it will help members of this committee to understand that these are all legitimate ways to present school funding information. And so when you see a number that says school funding increased by $8,000 per kid, absolutely true, Mr. Crow, and I will tell you. And if someone else says school funding increased from $3,600 to $4,200 over that same time period, we'd say that's true, too. And it's not that we can't make up our minds. It's that there's a lot of ways to present data. There's a lot of arguments about inflation factors. But this will help, I think, put some context for you when you hear these differing numbers of what's happened to school funding over time.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair and gentlemen, so another way of saying that is also that you have different inflationary factors depending on different inputs, if you will, right? So it leads me to ask questions about, so what's happening with special ed that creates this steep incline over time, and also, you know, what's happening with building costs. So it seems to me that from a policy perspective, it's important for us to grapple with the drivers beneath each of these disaggregated different inflationary realities. Is that safe to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, yes, it is. By way of background, on the building front, a couple of things happened since the early 80s that made a huge difference. One of those were the requirements for ADA came into play. Second were the asbestos removal requirements of the late 80s were very expensive for school districts. A third thing that's happened in Minnesota is our school districts tended to have relative building booms at various points in time. So the early 1900s, a lot of school buildings were built. During the baby boom period, during the 1950s, a lot of school buildings were built. And these sort of wear out kind of on a predictable schedule in some ways. And so there was a lot of replacement going on starting in the mid-90s and on the building front. And there's also the technology aspect of buildings. Even though the technology people often think of as the computers and those things, the electrical upgrades and the wiring upgrades that are necessary for technology have added costs to buildings. And frankly, I think there's a different expectation for what the physical plant should look like now than what it did 50 years ago. There tends to be more concern that there's adequate play areas around the buildings, the space footprint is larger, and there are additional requirements in terms of the ventilation systems that weren't there. So on the building front, all of those things have contributed. If I were to make a prediction, and I'm usually wrong on my predictions, my guess is that the building front is going to level out a bit in Minnesota for the next 10 or 15 years. A lot of districts have excess space now. A lot of districts have their buildings up to speed. There are a number of growing districts that are going to need new buildings. But generally speaking, I think that building line is actually going to slow down a bit. In terms of the special education, the issue there is a little harder, I think, in some ways to discuss. There certainly has been an increase in the special education pupils. As Mr. Crow showed you on that chart earlier, even with declining enrollment, the number of children and the percentage of children in Minnesota school districts that are receiving special education systems has increased over time. Second, as with all school spending, special education tends to be fairly staff intensive. And staff costs relative to other parts of the universe where there's more reliance on capital, schools are very staff dependent, and special education students are relatively staff dependent, and so the staff costs are a big driver on the increases in special education. In terms of that increase, we could get to some charts on this at a separate time, perhaps. We've had a number of changes in categorizations. The biggest of those has been a big growth in the number of students with autism. And many of the autism programs are very expensive. Some of the children with autism are in relatively inexpensive programs, but some of those programs are quite expensive. And all of those things have led to a special education system where the average increase across districts is in the 6 to 9% annual rate on a nominal basis.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these are the charts we're just on right now, of course, are my favorite charts because they enable me, and we just heard it's a very legitimate statement to make, they enable me to say that education funding hasn't been increased since 1984. And the factoring in the GDP, implicit price deflator, and then factoring out the increases in special education and the building debt expenses. If you do all those things, then we as a state have been very remiss in our funding of our students. And that's why we have so many districts, 90%, that have to pass levy referendums just to stay afloat for basics, not for extra things like those we're supposed to be for. So I just want to note these charts, and so that when I make that statement, Chair Graffalo or anyone else here has just heard it from our nonpartisan fiscal rock stars that that I made a legitimate statement. Education funding has not been increased. If you do the implicit price deflator, which economists say we must do, Republican former Commissioner Dan McElroy said we must do. You have to use that to be the accurate one and then factor out special ed, which school districts can't control, and building debt, which I hope we would all agree districts have to do. They can't control. You have to have buildings. But classroom funding or any other kind of funding for schools, minus those two categories, hasn't increased since 1984.
And Mr. Strong, let's talk about the implicit price deflator. Let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, I'm not familiar with your area of expertise in that area. Are you? I know this is not the tax committee, and that's usually where we bring this up. But are you familiar with the indicator and how it's reached? And
Mr. Chair, members, the primary difference is in with the CPI. Essentially, what that's based on is a market basket of goods that's allowing substitution effects to take place. So, for example, if pears get relatively more expensive and people decide to eat apples instead, when you use the CPI as a measure of inflation, what you're essentially doing is allowing the substitution. People might buy more pears or less pears, more apples if one gets more expensive. So the relative contents of that market basket are changing. So with the CPI, you're measuring sort of an overall change in price levels that allows substitution. With the GDP implicit price deflator, what's often used, that's a measure of the gross domestic product changed over time. And it's often by category, and one of the categories that's used is state and local government services. And what that's actually doing is saying, what does it cost to provide, essentially, a state and local government service in 2004, and what does it cost to provide that service now? And so for something like that, you're not allowing a substitution between capital and employment, for example. So if you've got a service-dependent and a wage-dependent industry like schools, for example, you're going to find that the implicit price deflator is a bigger number if the employee benefits and the salary in that area are going up relative to other things. The CPI is a much more general measure. Both have very legitimate uses. If you were to look at the literature, you'd find that both are widely used, and people make different arguments at different points in time about which is the right. I don't think there's a correct answer. They tell one different things, but they're both measures of how price levels are changing over time.
And Mr. Strom, the implicit price deflator, is that a statewide indicator or a regional indicator or a nationwide indicator?
Mr. Chair, members, the implicit price deflator is usually the GDP implicit price deflator. It's a national indicator, but then it's broken down by categories, and often the category that's used is the state and local government services. That's a national indicator of a thin range of economic activity, which is those services provided by state and local government. So it's not a Minnesota index, but it's an index of all states, state and local government services.
So hypothetically, if a state like California or New York, very large states, went out and, say, made their pension benefits more generous, would that have an upward revision in the inflation measure or a downward revision?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to be quibbling about something, but I think on the pension benefit, that may not factor into what's happening immediately because it's going to key off a yearly level. I don't think there's an accrued pension benefit to that.
I'm not
quite sure about that, but say it was a health benefit. Say that they gave them an additional health benefit that was recognized in that year. In that case, that would drive that relative amount up.
If, for example, my pension benefit, if there was an increase in the employer contribution rate,
as long as it were reflected in that service,
correct.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It probably comes as no surprise to anybody here that I tend to agree with Representative Greiling's assessment. I would also submit to the committee that if one takes a look at the state's constitution and the language in the Constitution about a uniform system of public education funding. It's also been since 1984 that Minnesota's system of education funding has become less uniform and more in violation, at least of the spirit of the state's constitution. And I take a great pause and am very concerned about that as one looks at school children throughout the state, metro, suburban, and greater Minnesota.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to wonder, I was wondering to myself then, how do we account for increases in teacher salary and in other salaries? Can we also analyze that under the CPI?
Mr. Crowell, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, an increase in teacher salary is going to be reflected, and state and local teacher salaries is going to be reflected in the implicit price deflator. So if the state and local government, in both the total and in the state and local government services portion of that, so if there's an increase in those activity, in those amounts, that would factor into what the CPI for, or I'm sorry, the implicit price deflator for that area would be showing.
Representative Erickson? Mr. Crow, Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, if only we had an economist in the room to explain this to us. If only such a man were here. Representative Bills.
Chairman, I was wondering if with the GDP deflator, if it does alter any of your price indices, just because there's a certain, it could be a certain industry capture or mandates associated with those government services, and does that then lead to the negative line that trends out over time?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, the trends over time, in some decades, the CPI has been much higher than the implicit price deflator, and others not. I think if you were to measure from 84 on, they've been almost the same, but in the last decade, the implicit price deflators had shown a higher inflation level than the CPI. If you were to go back to the 90s, I think that it's just the reverse. We've got data on this. We can dig out and show you how those two compare over time. But it depends on a number of factors as to which is going to be higher or lower, and it's not necessarily something that one can generalize about in the future. I wouldn't predict from the last 10 years of a low CPI and a relatively higher GDP implicit price deflator that the next decade would proceed the same way.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom.
Has there been any? Have you researched or seen any other states moving toward or away from the CPI or GDP deflator due to the hedonics or geometric weighting that takes place as these numbers are found? I was just curious to see if any states were looking at those mathematical considerations.
Representative Bills, do you mean like the compounding of it? Is that what you're saying there? I don't know what that means. That's why I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, members, what the representative's talking about is the different values. The hedonics of it reflects what happens to a car, for example. A car in 1980 had different functions than a car in 2010. So not only is the price level of that different, but the thing you're buying is different as well. And so there's an adjustment in the CPI that reflects that difference, that reflects that a car now or a computer now that you have a desktop computer that you had in 1984 would be different than a desktop computer that you've got now. And so it reflects that in it. I think the important point is for our purposes in the K-12 area, we don't really use the CPI in any of our formulas or the GDP implicit price deflator in our formulas. We're using it to show data There are some other areas of statute where there are inflators in statute, and they've had fights in those committees. The tax committee, for instance, on the taconite, there's an inflator built in there that there's been a fight about what the right number to
use. Yeah.
There's also been, not surprisingly, big fights at the state level about what the Department of Finance should use for showing their data. And surprisingly enough, perhaps, the opinion of the Department of Finance changed over the last 10 years, of which was the better measure. I don't think it's not a right or wrong issue in my mind. It's that it shows two different kinds of things, and one just needs to know what they're measuring and a little about the differences that they might see. But it could very well be in the next decade that the two are going to trend pretty close together and that there wouldn't be any difference in using either.
Sure. Yes. And Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
And Mr. Strom and Mr. Kroff, I think there's a member of tax staff who actually gave me the comparisons on CPI and the implicit price deflator. Might be good to get those numbers and share them with the committee.
Yeah.
And you hit the nail on the head, is that the purpose of this being in the presentation is so that when we hear Representative Growling or others reference those numbers, other members who may have a differing opinion don't think that she's lying or making stuff up. It is factually accurate. And likewise, when other members make different arguments referencing different numbers, that those members understand that those are factually accurate as well. The more complex the picture is, the more you have the ability to provide differing descriptions of what the data reports. So, Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it seems to me that part of Well, first of all, this is a good debate. It's a good discussion. But we're talking about different tools based on reality. And part of what we struggle with here is to make sure that we're making the right decisions, the best decisions we can, relative to what's actually going to happen in the classroom, how it's going to impact the relationship between teachers and students, you know, et cetera. And so it seems to me that part of what we also need to do, in addition to using these tools, is to try to get a stronger handle on the relationship between outlays of appropriations and levels of quality outcomes. And, you know, one of the frustrating things, I think, for many of us here is that I think we haven't always had that conversation. We've tended to have a conversation relative to whether or not, you know, one legislator is willing to appropriate more, another one's willing to appropriate less. And I think that one of the things I think we need to be challenged to is to really understand the relationship between appropriations and quality outcomes. And I think all of us have a sense that there ought to be a relationship. The question is, at what level? How do we measure that? And it seems to me that as we go forward in making our deliberations, we would be well advised to read the literature from different perspectives that's working on this area, and perhaps Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, it's something you can help us with as we go forward.
Mr. Strom. Okay. Sorry. In this, a question for you, Mr. Strom, since Mr. Crow, your wingman's left you up there. In terms of the, you know, the free and the reduced lunch count, we see, you know, special education, we have, mm-hmm. you know, diagnoses of autism, other factors driving increases in special education numbers while the student population's gone down. But we also see you know, the free and reduced lunch count rising at a disproportional level relative to rates of poverty or relative to rates of those indicators in Minnesota on a nationwide basis. What factors are going into that we're seeing this, you know, nearly 30% increase in free and reduced lunch count, 33 if you do it in a relative term? What accounts for that?
Mr. Chair, members, well, it's not just in Minnesota, but nationally, the families that have children are essentially poorer, relatively speaking, than they were 20 years ago on average. And so the number of free and reduced lunch and the percentage of free and reduced lunch students in Minnesota schools has been increasing over time. That just sort of matches the trend that's happened nationally with when we look at income data, that families with younger children tend to be poorer, relatively speaking, than they were 20 years ago. The other thing that's happened some in Minnesota, of course, is we're a state that has a lot of influx of students from other states and other nations, and the characteristics of our students have changed as well. But I'm not. We've got some data that we'll have available for you next week that shows how these free and reduced lunch counts have changed over the last decade by district, with some individual, you know, district examples for you. But in terms of how much different Minnesota is than the nation, I'm not quite sure. But it's a trend across the nation, and Minnesota is reflecting that there's been an increase in the number of students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch. One could argue, I think, about the, you know, if we're on the methodological measure, the standards for free and reduced lunch have not changed. There for free lunch, it's set at 130% of the poverty level, and for reduced price lunch at 185% of the poverty level. But one could argue about whether the poverty level as measured in 2010 is measuring the same thing as in 1984. But generally speaking, I think the short answer is that relatively speaking, younger people, families with younger children are relatively more poor than they were 20 years ago.
And I guess I wasn't trying to walk into making a specific point, but the overall point when you see all four of these indicators is that Minnesota is changing. I mean, historically, Minnesota used to be more white than the rest of the country. We had a lower percentage of people who are financially at risk. And our numbers are both demographically and based on income becoming more like the rest of the rest of the country.
Very much, Mr. Chair. Yes. Members, if you don't mind, we've had a bit of a discussion on the next couple of pages we've had a discussion on how these different numbers look. These are just broken out by region, by size of district. So we'll skip through those charts. On page 29, there's a chart that you can look at, I think, on your own time, some about how these different characteristics of the general ed formula have changed over time. And then we're going to just show you a couple other quick charts, but we want to get to the aid and levies today, even if we don't get to the printout. So we're going to go through the rest of this pretty quick here. One of the things that you're often asked is, gee, what's the state's commitment to education spending look like over time? And you can see here on page 31, this is just a chart of, and pardon the footer there, that's a beautiful footer. The chart here shows from 1984 to 2011, if you were to take the state aid component and the local property tax component of school funding and put them together so that they made 100%, how's that changed since 1984? And you can see it hung around 60% for most of the 80s and the early 90s, and then it gradually increased during the 90s. In fiscal year 2003, we had a big change in 2001, and the state made the commitment to put an additional amount of funding into K-12 in 2003 and reduce property taxes by about $1 billion. And you can see that great big jump there between 2002 and 2003 in the percentage. That reflects that change. And then since that time, you can see that the system has become gradually slightly more oriented to the property tax again. So we used to be in the 60s. We went all the way up to almost 90% funding from the state, and now we're back down to about 76-78%.
And Mr. Strom, I apologize for interrupting again, but just for the context of the committee, especially for newer members of the committee, how important that change was in the early part of the last decade to shift things. And I'm massively summarizing a very complex bill, but basically what the legislature agreed to do was reduce personal income tax rates and at the same time agree to take over a greater share of education funding. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. And we're all, you know, we'll have our disagreements later on in the committee, but as a simple proposition of mathematics, I mean, members of the committee need to understand that when you reduce inflows and you make promises and expenditures, you know, it's a matter of math. Those things don't add up.
Yeah, so. And Mr. Chair, one of the underlying rationale for the change in 2000 that the 2001 legislature made was that education was a state obligation and the state ought to be paying for it. And right after that change in 2001, the economy soured a bit, nothing like it's been the last couple of years, but there was a minor recession in 2000 that began then, and the states both made some income tax changes, lowered those rates, and had some reductions in income tax revenue, and all of a sudden many of the people who were arguing for state taking over the funding said, oh, wait, the property tax is a more reliable source of education. Maybe we of more stable source of education funding. Maybe we should keep more of that. And so you can see that there's gradually been a return to the property tax. Again, it's still above 75% state and about 25% local property tax.
Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, Mr. Strom, if you looked at this chart and let's say as we progress from 2010 onward, that line would move down towards 60%. one might judge that we are in the same situation we were in 1984. However, that would be very misleading, would it not, in terms of the function of the property tax in relation to the support of schools and the equity issue across schools? And I think it would be important to comment on.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhart, our school finance system up until 2001 was very heavily equalized. And this will be something that splits really not on party lines in the committee, but on what kinds of communities people represent. And with an equalized school funding system, essentially it was a rate equalized system. So we had a general education levy up through fiscal year 2002, and that general education levy was the same rate all across the state. So whether you were in Apple Valley or Mankato or Black Duck, the rate that was applied against the property was the uniform general education tax rate. And then subtracted from your revenue amount was the amount that was raised by that levy. And in very property-poor communities, again, it doesn't have anything to do with the income wealth, but on the property basis, in property-poor communities, that rate would raise a relatively small amount of money, so a greater share of state aid would flow to that community. In some of the suburban communities, like Representative Greiling's, that have high tax base per pupil, not anything about the income of the people there, prior to the 2001 changes, that rate maybe raised almost all of their general education revenue from the local property tax, so the state aid component to a district like Roseville was relatively small. And that was based on rate equalization that uses our underlying definitions of property, our net tax capacity tax base, as the basis for that, and then applied a uniform rate. Since 2001, the levies that have come back have been less equalized. We don't have a general education levy. And the equalization levels were not indexed for inflation or for growth in property values over time. And so our system is quite a bit less equalized now than it was back in the 90s, for example.
Follow up, Representative Reinhart? Oh,
okay. No, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Reinhart was reading ahead. If you turn to page 32, this shows the relative share of a couple of different programs that's paid for through the state aid on the equalization. And you can see that in the late 90s, the top line, the operating referendum, statewide, about a third of that was paid for with state aid and the two-thirds from local property taxes. By 2011, about 8% of the operating referendum was paid for by the state and 92% for the rest. I'd forgotten that this chart was in here, Representative Reinhart, or I would have turned the page. So then Mr. Crow's going to talk some now about shifts. We're trying to get a lot in today. Are we going just through 2:15, or what time do you have us?
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, we will stop at 2:15. If we do not get through the presentation, we will pick it up in the future.
Okay, very good.
So quality, not quantity.
Mr. Chair and members, let's talk a little bit about school finance shifts. We've got a basic summary on page 34 about how shifts come into play in the school districts. We've also had this Money Matters, or this document distributed to you, called State Education Funding Accounting Shifts. And at the request of the chair, I updated this for fiscal for the last couple of years of action by the legislature, and it hasn't been through our editing process, so if you find minor typos, just please ignore them. I think the content is still right, but we're just kind of printing it as I left for committee just now. But basically, and this will give you a lot more detail than what's on page 34, we don't have to go through this right now, but I'd point you to the back page as we talk about this. There's a description of kind of recent activity going back to 2002 in shifts and what we've changed. But basically, we have three kinds of shifts. Two of them save money for the state as you're appropriating, and one of them saves money for the state during the fiscal year in order to help the state's cash flow. So the first shift is the property tax recognition shift. And what that is it's a shift that's based on when school districts collect property tax payments for their levy revenue. So as you know, if you pay your property taxes, your property tax payments are made in May and October of a calendar year. And if there wasn't a shift in place, with some small exceptions, those payments would be applied for a school district as revenue for the fiscal year that starts in that summer of the calendar year. So in other words, for last calendar year, calendar year 2010, the May 2010 and the October 2010 property tax payments were revenue for the 2010-2011 fiscal year. So for the school year that started last fall, they were collecting money in May and October that was revenue for that fiscal year. What a property tax shift does is say, and this says June because that's when the school districts actually get the that May payment, is the property tax shift says instead of moving that spring payment into the subsequent fiscal year, the school district has to count that as revenue for the current fiscal year that's about to end. And the way that saves the state money is that when the state makes its aid payments, the year that that payment is shifted into that fiscal year, the state basically says, while you're getting this much property tax revenue, we're going to reduce your aid payments by the amount of property tax, extra property tax revenue you've collected for that, that's being recognized for this fiscal year. And so basically the state offsets that early recognized property tax and books the savings on a one-time basis, because then the next year everything is shifted forward and school districts are counting it and the state is, you know, basically moving it to the next fiscal year. And so then in the next fiscal year the state pays additional aid to offset what was the reduced amount in the current fiscal year. And so on a one-time basis, so say a district was collecting $100 million in property tax revenue, the shift percentage is 48.6%. So the state would pay $48.6 million less in revenue to that school district for that fiscal year. And then the next year, everything would be back to 100%. It's just that the district would be counting the fall payment and then the next spring payment as being in the current fiscal year. And so the state on a one-time basis would show savings from that, and that was that shift, kind of shift, has been implemented in the past and was just recently implemented last session in 2010. The other shift that is used to save the state money on an appropriations basis, and now we need to get into another definition of terms. As we talk about funding, you will hear us refer to aid entitlements and aid appropriations. Entitlements isn't really the kind of entitlement you hear about in the healthcare area. Basically, the word entitlement means what does the formula generate in revenue for a school district. So if a school district has 10 pupils and the formula is $100 per pupil, the $1,000 that generates is what we call the aid entitlement. That's what the district is entitled to receive as revenue for that fiscal year for that formula. Now, the state has really, well, never in recent past, I don't know about the early 1900s, but in recent past, has never paid the full entitlement during a current year for a set of programs, the general ed programs and some other appropriations. There are some that are paid 100%, but usually we shift some of those payments into a subsequent fiscal year. The practical reason for this is that over the course of the fiscal year, districts are still counting and reporting students, and we don't have final data until the next fiscal year. And so that what would happen was when we had a 90%, 10% payment percentage, we'd pay 90% of that in the example, that $1,000, $900 would get paid in the current fiscal year. And then we'd make a makeup payment, we call it, in the next fiscal year of the $100 that was still due from the previous fiscal year. And then that $100 would be adjusted if there were more or less pupils by the actual number of pupils that were there. And the changing that shift or that payment percentage saves the state money because the state and school districts use different accounting methods. And this is also jargony, but the state uses cash accounting and the districts use accounts receivable accounting. Or basically the state, whenever it makes a payment, that's when it counts. Whenever it receives tax revenue, that's when it counts, in that fiscal year that the payment was received. School districts using accrual accounting basically count the expense and the revenue in the year in which it's accrued. So in a current fiscal year, they count that entitlement as the full amount of revenue that they're entitled to get.
And Mr. Crowley, just Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Crowley, I got a question. You had alluded to the history of past shifts, and I noticed on page 44 you've got SOD. Is there any correlation between past shifts and a spiking or increase in SOD? And is there any trend? I know you don't have final data for the past year, 2010, but is there any trend caused by the recent shifting?
Mr. Crow, I knew I was going to do that. Dang it, Mr. Crow. I called him representative.
And members, there really isn't a correlation. And one thing that we've done and the legislature has done in the past to help deal with that is that when we change payment shifts and say go to a 70-30 payment shift where we're only paying 70% in the current year, which is going to have a cash flow impact on the school district, districts that are in statutory operating debt are allowed to apply to the commissioner for a waiver of that shift and basically continue to be funded at the current payment percentage at 90-10 basically. And so when the shift causes cash flow for districts are able to deal with that. Many districts have fund balances, and we have data on fund balances that districts have, and they use that fund balance data. In fact, Mr. Strom just put a chart up about the percentage of fund balance as a percentage of expenditures. Some districts have pretty significant fund balances, and they use those to deal with the cash flow issues brought on by shifts. Districts that have to borrow in the last year, as we've looked at this issue because of the shift put in place, we're seeing districts getting rates of 1-2% on their loans to do that borrowing, because we basically allow districts to use their future payments from the state as collateral. We have a system called aid anticipation certificates where districts can borrow against future payments, which gives them a really good a rate when they go to borrow that money. And so while it's not insignificant and it's important for districts, in the macro sense, it's a pretty small number, that borrowing cost, whether it's lost interest on fund balances or whether it's additional borrowing costs due to short-term borrowing for cash flow reasons.
Representative Fung?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. I want to thank you because it alleviated some concerns brought up by media about the hardship, and I'm glad to see that there are compensatory things that we've done to alleviate those concerns.
Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, I think with that what we will do is I would suggest that everybody take your materials and put them in your save folder, and we will get to those at a future committee hearing. But before we go, Representative Greiling, you had a question or comment or skewering you ready to give me?
Mr. Chair, since I am now you and you are now me, I get to ask out of the blue questions at the end of the committee hearing for those who weren't on this committee last year. This is an easy one, though. I'm sitting here with Chair Erickson to my left, and you're over there. And I'm just wondering, there's a lot of interest in the alternative teacher licensure here in the education committees, but some of us serve on one and some of us serve on the other and some of us are on both. Is that coming to this committee or will it go straight to the floor?
Representative Greiling, my intent would be that that bill would come to this committee.
Thank you.
Any other questions at all? Or Representative Greiling, did you have anything else, or that was it?
Mr. Chair, I don't right now. Thank you.
Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, on the baseline spreadsheet that gets sent out, looks like the House districts, the legislative districts, might got knocked down a couple columns. Looks like they're not matching up. If we could just get that fixed.
Mr. Chair, we'll check on that. We've got a fancy new feature where we're letting on the computerized version of it, you can type in your district number and it'll just show your districts. And I think maybe the one we sent down to printing didn't have that feature built in and might have had an error on that. So
that
we'll throw this and we'll reprint it for Thursday's hearing.
All right. Well, good committee hearing, members. And we'll remember tomorrow is the One Minnesota Conference, so there's no committees tomorrow, but we'll see everyone on Thursday. The meeting is adjourned.